Surprise, listeners. Chris Chavez here with a little quick episode of the Serious Mag podcast. Just a brief chat that we had with Dr. Michael Joyner of the Mayo Clinic, who back in 1991 published a paper that said it was physiologically possible for a human to run about a 158. So with this sub 2-hour marathon attempt this weekend, we decided to give him a quick call. Here is Dr. Michael Joyner. And we're joined now by Dr. Michael Joyner on a little bonus episode of the Serious Mag podcast. Doc, how's it going?
Couldn't be better, Chris. How are you?
Pretty good, pretty good. So I'm guessing you've received quite a bit of attention recently, especially with this week's big sub-2-hour marathon attempt that Nike's going to put on. And so back in the day, you wrote something about the kind of like the limit that the human body could push itself. And I think the conclusion was something like a 158, 157 marathon. Just take us through a couple years back, how you came to that sort of a conclusion and where we stand now.
Well, Chris, it's sort of a long narrative. I ran track and field at the University of Arizona, where I like to tell people I was good enough to get lapped by Alberto Salazar in the 10,000 meters of the then Pac-10 championships. But as a result of that, I'd been a subject in some of the early studies on the lactate threshold and got involved in human exercise physiology research as a result of my interactions with Pete Farrell, a man named Eddie Coyle, who's well known, and also the late Jack Wilmore. And so what happened is I was doing this during medical school in the 1980s, some ideas about how maximal oxygen uptake, the lactate threshold, and running economy emerged to define performance. They emerged and came together. And so I was sitting around with a programmable calculator ditching medical school one day and just said, what would happen if the person or a model person had the best values ever reported for all three variables, the highest VO2 max ever, the best lactate threshold, the best running economy? And I found these variables, sort of put them together and started thinking, gee, it could be pretty fast. So that was kind of the beginning of this in the middle 1980s. So then I went and got some individual data on running economy from Jack Daniels and other people who had studied elite athletes at very high speeds and sort of started to collect this data, put it together, came up with a more formal model, and published a paper just after medical school in 1991 on the possibility that somebody could break 2 hours for the marathon. So that's how it sort of started. It then was sort of a dormant issue for 20 years or so until people started taking pretty big bites out of the record the last 5, 6, 7 years. And then people began to get more interested in it.
What's it been like to watch this evolution of the marathon and people getting closer and closer for you? Did it excite you a little bit?
Yeah, it does excite me. It's interesting because when I wrote the paper, you know, one of the reasons you make mathematical models or do modeling in science is to try to identify gaps in knowledge. When I made the model, the record was right around 207, and it was kind of the beginning of the professional era. The East Africans were starting to migrate from the track races and cross country to the marathon and so forth. And one of the things the paper did is identify knowledge gaps, specifically about efficiency and or what's called running economy. Things about VO2 max and the lactate threshold were very well known in the 80s and 90s. So one of the things I find most interesting is that Nike in specific and also Adidas are trying to improve running efficiency or running economy by making better shoes or footwear. In this attempt, Nike is also trying to, what you might say, manage efficiency or economy even more by having a drafting scheme and also maximizing the course, limiting right angle turns, things like that. So I think their focus on efficiency or economy really is very validating in the sense that I had identified this through the modeling as the main area of a gap in knowledge. So I'm very happy to see this occur. I hope they take a nice bite out of the record, and I hope this leads to more formal attempts to break these sorts of records.
How much can just advanced footwear go? Because I feel like there's part of it, it's like you can do as much to create, you know, the fancy shoes that will get it done. And, you know, obviously there's the question of how legal these types of shoes are and stuff like that, but that all gets sorted out afterwards. But I guess also there's the mental wall also that plays a factor into it. What are some of these other outside factors that maybe we aren't thinking about right away?
If you look at the physiology of elites, and what's known about running economy, lactate threshold, and VO2 max, I mean, people have recorded very remarkable values for those, you know, since the 1960s or 70s, and in some of the variables, specifically VO2 max before that. And people have been training about as hard as possible since, you know, the time of Emil Zatopek, and certainly by the time of Herb Elliott, Jim Ryan, Peter Snell, and other kind of luminaries from the 1950s and 60s. So I don't think we can do a whole lot with training, as much as people would like to talk about the latest and greatest new form of training. Usually it's a recycled idea. I think running surfaces, shoes, and so forth can help to some extent. I think pacing can help in terms of some of the mental barriers. And I think what's interesting is we now saw Mary Katanier in 217 a couple weeks ago at London. And what I find most interesting about that is A, she ran 217, but that Paula Radcliffe's world record for women, where she was more or less paced because it was a mixed race, is still about a minute and a half faster than that. I think Ms. Radcliffe ran 2:15:25, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that does help with the mental effort, and I think this is where the pacing or a strong competitive race can help with a men's record. So I think all of those things can sort of work together, and I think you know, you've seen examples where people in every sport now try to optimize all elements of their performance to get marginal gains. And what I like to tell people is that, you know, in the lab, we can only measure things typically within 1 or 2%. If you win a 10,000-meter race by 1%, you win by 100 meters. So trying to optimize each individual kind of small marginal gain can pay off in this context. And remember, they're trying to break this record, Chris, by about 2.5%, which is a big margin. But, you know, even if they get 1 or 1.5%, that's still very, very impressive.
The thing that's interesting about Kometo's record, though, is also that he had that 5K late in the game. I think it might have been from 30 to 35 or 35 to 40, where it was just this incredible jump in pace. And the way we've seen some of these attempts go, it's just, all right, let's try and run, you know, 60, 61 through the half, and then afterwards just hold on to see how close they can get. And Mary Katani's run
was a little bit suicidal.
Yeah. And so I guess –
And Radcliffe's run was evenly paced.
Yeah.
Or she negative split.
The ideal – what's the ideal, I guess, plan here? Because I guess to show this off for Nike, it seems like going over 60 at the half – would be a nightmare scenario, because it'd probably be really tough to negative split under 60 there. So pacing wise, what would maybe be the ideal situation?
Well, you know, I looked at this and I think the last fast half somebody's run, I think Kometo ran 61:15 or something like that. I looked it up a couple days ago. So I think if they could, you know, if they could be in the high 59s, they would have a chance. And so I think my guess is they're trying to run 59:30 or 59:45. I have not talked to the folks involved in this directly about their pacing scheme. I've talked to them about other things. And I know, of course, Brad Wilkins worked with me, and then Andy Jones I know well, Phil Skiba I know. So I think, you know, that would be my guess, but I have not had a direct conversation. I don't have any inside information. So that's what I would try to do, but I think you are correct that some of these record attempts have been very evenly placed or slightly negatively splitted.
And it's interesting because their pacing strategy here, it's going to be with guys going in and out and having six guys with the three main guys. We've never seen anything done like this, and it's also partly why it probably won't count for a world record. How different do you think that might, and how effective would that be for the three guys, you know, to see someone like Bernard Lagat hop in and be able to hold that easy 4:30, 4:35 pace around there, and it's just kind of like these little surges. And
well, I think it'd be very, very helpful, you know, using the Paula Radcliffe example. Perhaps, you know, it could get him a minute and a half if you compare her to Katanning. just as a back of the envelope sort of thing, I think then the actual physiology of drafting, there's some pretty good data on people who are running quite fast, at least British distance runners from the late 60s and early 70s, showing that people might get 2-4% from drafting if they did it correctly. So I think that maybe even more. So I think that that's real. So I think the psychology would be important, but I think the physiology would also be helpful. And one of the things I joke about, Chris, is, or at least in kind of my next 15 minutes of fame, one of the things I'd like to see is to see somebody like Richard Branson set up a kind of the equivalent of a Masters golf tournament. Every 2 years, get the top 40 or 50 distance runners together, both men and women, and set up a more formal attempt to break 2 hours in an excellent course on a good day, so on and so forth. Try to optimize everything as Nike is, but then set up a prize money scheme to get everybody to certain intermediate splits below a certain time and try to reward as many people as possible to get to 30, 35, 40 Ks and see if you could do this in a real competitive race. And then do the same thing for women with a goal of 215.
Obviously, drug testing has probably been carried out. Nike said, I think that they were having some drug testing on their own, and then the athletes would be open to out-of-competition testing and that sort. But from your perspective, doping and in the marathon, how much of a benefit do some of these runners see? We've seen, I guess, Rita Jeffcoe post these fast times in Boston. I guess from the science perspective, if it wasn't like for this staged course and this attempt, how much doping would probably be necessary to cut 3% off of the world record?
It's hard to put a direct figure on it, but what I like to tell people about doping is in the current format with the current test, if doping is carried out rigorously, fairly, and done in the state-of-the-art lab, I think you can eliminate what I call industrial strength doping. In other words, people having blood counts of 60 as opposed to 45, like we heard about in the middle 1990s. Would people still be tempted to microdose? Sure. And what I think you've seen over the last 10 years is in the Tour de France and also in distance running, at least on the track, a stabilization of times, and you haven't seen nearly so many outlier times. So I think the days of industrial strength doping are over. I think that, again, my comment about 1% is a tiny microdose, which might get people, a little bit, a half a percent or even a tenth of a percent, is enough to give people the margin of victory. So could somebody get 1 or 2% via, for example, EPO use and maybe some other things? Perhaps, but again, we're at the limits of how that can be detected, both through analytical testing and physiologically. So I think you just don't know. But clearly people with low-dose doping can still get an edge, and I think it's probably still enough to be the margin of victory under some circumstances.
You said 158 back in the day, but now I guess your hope is just sub-2 in your lifetime. Is that still what you're thinking?
Well, I think what I really give the Nike guys a lot of credit for is I never anticipated anybody would try a moonshot. I guess that's what I missed. I think this idea that it would just sort of occur naturally and people would take a bite here, a bite there, and then eventually a Jim Ryan or Katie Ledecky or Secretariat-like individual would emerge and have the perfect race on the perfect day under the perfect circumstances on the right course. That was how it would be kind of a stochastic event. Or kind of a one-off type of thing. But I think now that with this idea that people are going to try to actually engineer records in the marathon, like they've been doing for years in the mile, I think we might see it a little bit sooner. So our projections in the early 2010s were that it might happen sometime in the late 2020s or perhaps in the 2030s. But I think with this Nike attempt, that we're going to see more of this. And there's an independent attempt being spearheaded by Giannis Pitsilatis. And then my guess is, especially if Nike gets close, that their competitors at Adidas will try to figure out some way to respond.
What's, I guess, your prediction for this weekend? Do you think
the wild card to me is the weather. I think it's wonderful they decided to do it in May as kind of an homage to Roger Bannister and try to have it be as close to his date of breaking 4 minutes as possible. Chris, but I think you just don't know what the weather is going to be like in terms of both wind and temperature. And I like to look at it more like a bookmaker, and you see sometimes on Twitter I post an over-under. So I would pick the over-under at 21-30. That's my best guess, you know, maybe 21-20. And then I think there's a 5 or 10%, maybe 15% chance that they break 2 hours. But, you know, what were the odds that Donald Trump was going to win? What were the odds that Brexit was going to win? And what were the odds that with 15 minutes to go in the Super Bowl, that the New England Patriots were going to win? So 10 or 15% or last year that the Cleveland Cavaliers were going to come back. So I think, so I think 10 or 15% are not insignificant odds in an athletic event where there's so much left to chance.
So the first guy to ever run a marathon died. Roger Bannister collapsed after his 4-minute mile. What happened?
Right.
And what could happen to someone who breaks 2 hours for the marathon health-wise?
Nothing. They'll probably do like, you know, if you look at the there's some pretty good data on ex-Olympians, but there's some excellent data on people who've been finishers of the Tour de France, and they live to be old, healthy men.
Any last thoughts on the attempt?
No, I'm on call in the hospital on over the weekend, and I will follow it on the internet with great interest, and hope that they set a world record for sure. And hope that they, in fact, run 159.59. And if Richard Branson's listening, I'd be more than willing to talk to him or some other magnate about how somebody might set up something similar to the Masters tournament for distance running in general and the marathon in specific.
Mary Wittenberg's a friend of the show, and she's working directly under Richard Branson, so we might be able to get a hold of him.
That would be terrific to visit with Ms. Wittenberg about this.
Yeah, absolutely. Mike, it was a pleasure. I really want to thank you for taking the time to do this.
All right, great. Thanks a lot, Chris. We'll talk later, I'm sure.
There you have it. Quick little chat with Dr. Michael Joyner. Thanks to him for taking the time. And we'll have another episode later this week with Pat Casey. So subscribe on iTunes, leave a 5-star review, and tell your friends about the City of Smack podcast.